On This Week in Enterprise Tech, you ever wonder what happens to your device's data when you sell it on eBay? Well, it definitely ain't safe, that's for sure. We'll talk about some data leaks there. You ever do any threat modeling? Well, Curtis is going to take us through threat modeling basics using MITRE ATT&CK. Plus, Brian Curtis and I talk with a great guest, Mike Cotton, SVP of Engineering at Digital Defense, to talk vulnerabilities and threat management. Twiet on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 392, recorded May 8th, 2020. Vulnerability and Threat Management with Digital Defense. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LinkedIn Learning. A lot of things are changing in our professional lives. With over 16,000 courses taught by industry experts, LinkedIn Learning is where you can get the skills that can help you and your career. Keep learning to rise to any moment. Try 1 month free at linkedinlearning.com/twit. And by Pfingst Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit. Enter the code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the senior editor over at Dark Reading. Curtis, great to see you, my friend. What's been going on this past week for you?
Well, it's just been another week in paradise here in the swamp. The weather's good. The distances are social. And fortunately for me, the cyber criminals are still busy. Lots of interesting stuff going on. And I do actually have some breaking news. Today, it was announced that for 2020, both Black Hat and DEF CON will be online events only. The physical in-person events for both of those has been canceled. And I think it says a lot about the event and the organizers that DEF CON already has a series of t-shirts out commemorating the event. So it's going to be interesting. I know the people at Black Hat. They are putting a lot of effort into making sure this is going to be a great event, even if it's not person to person. So stay tuned. Lots more news to come. But that was the big breaking news of this afternoon.
Thanks, Curtis. Well, speaking of busy, we have our favorite geek in paradise from the great state of Hawaii, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, how is retirement treating you?
I'm actually way busier than I was before. I'm actually working with my campus security, otherwise now called Department of Public Safety. I don't know why everybody changed their names to that. Public Safety. Anyway, unfortunately, a lot of people inherit old infrastructure, and emergency call boxes have been around for a very, very long time, and some of them are really and truly ancient. They're still POTS, plain old telephone system-based systems, and a blue light, and that's it. So what I'm attempting to do is introducing some new, relatively new technology. In this case, I'm looking at transition networks. It'll allow me to run power over Ethernet gig over two wires, which ought to be really interesting. Very it's cool. Not cheap. No stretch of the matter. You know, we're still talking about $400 or $500 per installation, but it's a lot cheaper than hiring a contractor to dig up the street or dig up the sidewalk to put new conduits in so that we can put a modern call box with enough conduit for cameras and things like that. So I will report back on how well it works. But I have used a PoE over coax solution at Lions Arboretum so that we can stretch way the heck out beyond the into the deep forest so we can provide wireless connectivity to science projects. So me and weird connectivity solutions are us.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Chibert. Well, speaking of busy, we have quite the week in enterprise news. Ever wonder what happens to your data when you sell your devices on eBay or the open market? Well, definitely ain't safe, that's for sure. We'll talk about the recent data leaks there. You ever do any threat modeling? Well, Curtis is going to take us through some threat modeling basics using the MITRE ATT&CK. Plus, we have a great guest, Mike Cotton, SVP of Engineering at Digital Defense, to talk security and vulnerability management. But first, this week's been busy in the enterprise news, so let's go ahead and jump in to this week's blips. We all know that this is a challenging time for everyone, especially organizations. Now, for some organizations, they're slowly withering away, and others are actually getting hit hard with new business due to how essential they are. But Amazon is actually one of those, and it seems that they're actually also struggling to figure out the right course of action for many things related to COVID-19. In fact, a highly visible employee, distinguished engineer and VP, has decided to give the issues at the company and people calling them out a voice. Now, last year, a group was created internally at Amazon called the Amazon Employees for Client Justice, and they called for dramatic action from leadership from Amazon on the global client emergency. Now, the same group came to aid during the latest COVID-19 crisis. Now, when the COVID-19 crisis emerged this year, many stories surfaced of unrest in Amazon work warehouses, workers raising alarms about being uninformed, unprotected, and even frightened. Now, Amazon official statements claimed that every possible safety precaution has been taken. But then a worker organization for better safety conditions was fired, and brutally insensitive remarks appeared in leaked executive meeting notes where the focus was on defending Amazon's talking points. Now, warehouse workers reached out to the AECJ for more support. An announcement sent to the internal mailing list promoting a petition from that group and speech caused behind the scenes movements at Amazon, causing two of the most visible leaders from that group to be fired on the spot that same day. Now, Tim calls out that since he was a VP and he didn't want to go publicly rogue on this since he didn't agree, so he actually attempted to escalate this internally with the appropriate people and groups. Unfortunately, it fell on deaf ears, and as Tim proclaimed, he couldn't in good conscience not resign. In fact, he did it at such great personal and financial loss because he was giving up over $1 million in shares. In fact, in Tim's words, he said, "Firing whistleblowers isn't just a side effect of macroeconomic forces, nor is it an intrinsic to the function of free markets. It's evidence of a vein of toxic running through the company culture. I choose neither to serve nor drink that poison." Now, if this proves anything, it means that there must be a better balance of power in organizations, and the voice of all should be heard, even in the face of ambiguity.
Well, in other really good news, malicious bots are infiltrating online food delivery apps. In this strange new era of COVID-19, securing a grocery delivery slot can occasionally feel like hitting the lottery. You almost have to blink to believe it's real when you finally get a slot. And as demand for these online grocery shops have risen, so has the availability of new browser extensions to help shoppers game the delivery system. In recent weeks, developers have released add-ons that perform functions like scanning for and alerting users to delivery slots, completing the checkout, and inadvertently presenting a pathway for malicious bots to harvest user information. According to Ido Safruti, co-founder and CTO of Perimeter X, shoppers looking to secure highly coveted delivery time slots now have the option of installing browser extensions or using scripts to automate the process. These often perform tasks beyond what you installed them for. For example, they could be infected or malicious, harvesting personally identifiable information for future use or logging keystrokes to get passwords and account numbers that you don't want to share. Now, from mid-January to mid-March, food and grocery delivery experienced a 41% increase in traffic, both legitimate and malicious. Bad traffic includes malicious bots that execute attacks, including account takeover and web scraping. Professor William Kress of Governor State University, who's an expert in fraud detection and goes by the moniker Professor Fraud, says the app firm should comb their code line by line and go through it with a fraudster mindset to see what might be exploited. Enterprises should expect to see more attacks on delivery services as people continue to rely on having groceries, meals, medicines, and other essentials delivered to their doorstep. There's now more money being spent on food and household items than on live entertainment and other previously lucrative fields for hackers because, as we all know, criminals attack successful apps because, well, that's where the money is.
Well, it was bound to happen, and the internet is in a firestorm over this. Wink Smart Hub users get only 1 week's notice to pay up or lose access. A popular smart home hub is suddenly a lot less popular with its users after making a surprise announcement that customers will have to start paying a monthly subscription fee next week or lose access altogether. The Wink Hub first launched in 2014, promising a way for smart home enthusiasts to connect and control all their devices at once through one master interface. Basically, Wink exists to simplify life for someone whose lights, locks, thermostat, cameras, and appliances all come from different brands and therefore need different apps to operate. Anyway, lots of platforms exist, and Wink just decided, apparently, oh, it's going to be free. And they had a lot of people that decided to jump on the bandwagon. Now, way back when I started looking around and I started playing with Internet of Things and smart home devices, I looked at that and go, wow, that looks really cool. And then I went looking around to see how much it costs and said free. And I said, no, that sounds way too good to be true. So I'm going to say I'm not surprised. And, you know, when IFTTT stopped providing what I really needed, that's when I went looking. So instead, I'm using Node Red, which is a drag and drop JavaScript based system that has connectors for lots and lots and lots of smart home devices so that I can link them together. So ought to be interesting. Now, I also suspect, and this is my suspicious mind going, that someday I'm going to get a Dear Brian letter from Amazon saying that portions of my Amazon Echo services are also no longer free. So the world of IoT is a-changing, and it's no free lunch.
Now, with more and more organizations looking for better ways to work remotely, sharing files remotely has become a necessity. Well, if you're using Citrix Shared File Service, you might want to evaluate the latest news. Now, Share a File is a service intended for businesses that need a system for content collaboration, file sharing, and synchronization. Now, data is available from on-premises or cloud storage zones and passes to the user in a secure way via a storage zones controller. Unfortunately, three big gapping security vulnerabilities were found in that system. Now, this was evident not by a known exploit in the wild, but because Citrix itself has fixed three vulnerabilities in multiple versions of Shared File Storage Zone Controller. Now, the fun part of the vulnerability is that they could be exploited without authentication for access to private data areas. Now, although there is no evidence of anyone exploiting this just yet, especially since no technical details of the vulnerability exist, but it also means you might want to take action on your accounts. Now, how should your organization protect themselves? Well, for the time being, technical details for the vulnerability might be undisclosed, but customers that have storage zones managed by Citrix do not need to do anything. That's right. Customers that manage the zones themselves, though, should ensure that they run a supported version and then run the mitigation tool from Citrix themselves. Now, a simple tool that checks if a shared file server is vulnerable to the CVE-2020-7473 is available over there on GitHub by a really great fellow ethical hacker and system engineer. So check out that link in the story. Now, I guess this just means that we go back to our essential ask of all IT pros and enterprise professionals. Just make sure you keep your systems up to date.
Well, if you're working at home, you probably know DocuSign. And DocuSign is the vehicle for a phishing campaign using COVID-19 as bait. DocuSign users on Office 365 are the target of a new phishing campaign that features COVID-19 as a lure to convince them to offer up their credentials in return for pandemic information. According to researchers at Abnormal Security, 50 to 60,000 DocuSign users have received the phishing email, which purports to be an automated message from DocuSign carrying a link to a COVID-related document. The malicious link to the document employs a three-level redirect to obfuscate the actual destination, confuse automated security, and make sure that you want to go to a page that looks like a DocuSign login page. Once visitors are there, the attacker steals any entered credentials for the DocuSign account and their email account. The campaign uses a combination of trust and DocuSign, increased use of the service because of the risk of rise of working from home, and obfuscated URLs to create a malicious message that has a potential to be incredibly effective.
You know, does your Android Wi-Fi MAC address keep changing? So I'm leaving the discussion on what's good or bad about this latest Android update to our other show, All About Android. But a buddy of mine just discovered the hard way that a tiny new Android feature has some pretty big ramifications if you're using MAC address authentication for your enterprise Wi-Fi system. Simply put, the new version of Android has a default feature where it reports a random MAC address over Wi-Fi. And unless you opt in to keep it static, it's going to keep changing every time you restart your device. He found it because our MAC address authentication no longer matched what was in our Radius server and no more Wi-Fi.
Now, we haven't talked too much about the FCC lately, but just recently they made a decision to allow Virginia-based satellite communications company Ligado to deploy a nationwide mobile network, even though it could have adverse effects on GPS signals that are integral to the military's operations. Well, this didn't go over so well, and many officials, including at the Pentagon, are coming back to criticize the decision. Now, trouble in paradise, it seems to be. Now, according to the Pentagon officials, they believe that while Americans at home are typically not under threat of purposeful electronic attack, the GPS services they depend on every day for life and livelihood are though also threatened if the GPS signal and its environment are not protected from disruption. In fact, they noted that this is a complex issue and it's ultimately boiled down to risk. And risking GPS signals for the benefit of one company and its investors is kind of a bad idea. Now, this is ongoing ask from Ligado. In fact, since 2015, the satellite company has been working on a proposal for a network that would utilize the L-band spectrum. Now, the L-band spectrum is used to transmit GPS signal as it can cut through obstacles such as clouds, fog, rain, storms, and vegetation, which is why the Department of Defense has been wary of the company's plan. Now, Ligado has said that the network based on the spectrum would allow telecom companies to deploy 5G networks. Now, despite the Pentagon's concerns, the five-member FCC approved Ligado's proposal last month. Now, I guess if Ligado moves forward with it, you might want to just trust GPS even less than you do now. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have a really great sponsor we have to thank, and that's LinkedIn Learning. Now, I can tell you from experience, LinkedIn Learning has amazing set of professional courses on it. I've gone through countless hours of courses on there. And I remember how I was telling you about LinkedIn Learning and all the courses they have taught by industry experts. Well, they have more than 16,000 courses out there. And on top of that, they're also offering some super valuable and amazing courses for free. Now, I've taken the Managing in Difficult Times course.
I'll share with you how to become the catalyst for change, ways you can inspire and focus your organization, and I'll cover communication strategies so you can gain true commitment and game-changing solutions from your team.
So this is a super good course. And as they say in the course, tough times is what separates managers from leaders. Now, this course goes through what leaders do to manage effectively in difficult times. Now, if you're looking for some inspiration, this definitely is the course for you. Now, there's also a ton of other great courses offered for free as well. There's one that 10 ways to stay motivated while job hunting, digital network strategies, marketing on LinkedIn. There's also productivity tips, finding your productive mindset. In fact, there's one about grit and how teams persevere to accomplish great goals. And in fact, the last one is totally relevant in this time, in this climate. It's about managing virtual teams. Now, you'll receive custom tailored course recommendations, and each lesson will use project files and quizzes so you can practice while you learn. Courses are available anytime on a computer or phone, and you'll earn a certificate when you complete a course. Now, get LinkedIn Learning for your team. It's a faster way to learn and apply new skills to grow your business. Learn from expert instructors and connect with a global network of experience all on your time. So keep learning the skills you need to rise to any moment and try 1 month free at linkedinlearning.com/twit. That's linkedinlearning.com/twit. And we thank LinkedIn Learning for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, this problem exists when anytime you recycle your hardware. You don't clear it off before selling it. You're going to actually leak some data eventually. Now, heck, I used to throw away full writable CDs without microwaving them or shattering them. In fact, eBay is always a place where data-hungry people prowl. In fact, it's basically hacker's delight over there. And it works for hackers. It works for the feds, too. In fact, the feds and even companies like Avast purchase used phones from eBay to see what kind of data they can take off of them. Now, or they reverse it and they use it to actually sell a device to actually get it marked. Now, think about what kind of spy work that is. Now, in this case, what has come up recently is not simply a data device like cell phone. This is actually car parts. Now, there is a huge reseller market for car parts, and Tesla is also included in that market. In fact, Tesla infotainment systems are well sought out in the aftermarket world. Among other things, they display Netflix or YouTube videos, run Spotify, they connect to Wi-Fi, and of course, store phone numbers of contacts. But those benefits require storing heaps of personal information that an amateur researcher found can actually reveal owners' most sensitive data. Now, get this. The researcher went and acquired 13 Tesla media control units that were removed from electrical vehicles during repair and refurbishment. Now, each one of the devices stored a treasure trove of sensitive information despite being retired. Now, examples of information include phone books from connected cell phones, call logs containing hundreds of entries, recent calendar entries, Spotify and Wi-Fi passwords stored in plain text, locations for homework and other places navigated to, and session cookies that allowed access to Netflix and YouTube and attached Gmail accounts. Ugh. Now, all 13 of the devices show that their last location was at Tesla Service Center, an indication that they were removed by an authorized Tesla technician. Now, 12 of those units were actually come from eBay. Okay, so I'm going to bring my co-host in. Curtis, what do you think of this? I mean, since Tesla service centers removed these units, could Tesla be maybe held accountable for this?
Well, I think the question of whether they're going to be held accountable focuses almost entirely on what kind of terms the service agreement, the terms of service that the owner of the car has signed up for when they began using the car. My guess is somewhere buried in the language is something that says that Tesla's not responsible for a darn thing. And courts will tell us just how enforceable that is. You know, this reminds me a great deal of a conversation that came up a number of years ago when it was first realized that the same controller that is responsible for deciding whether or not airbags are going to fire, the black box, if you will, of a car, also contains information on acceleration, braking, G-forces, sometimes steering, all kinds of things. That's data about the vehicle and its movement. Question is, who owns that data? Because the police decided that it was free for anyone to use, so they began going in and grabbing it to use in accident reconstruction. Of course, insurance companies wanted access to it to decide whether or not they were going to pay out particular claims. And many drivers said, hey, wait a minute, it's our car, it's our data. These are some very seriously gray areas in law. And so I think the big rule is to be aware that your automobile, if it's probably less than 5 years old, is collecting all kinds of data on you and your activities. And you should assume that that data belongs to anyone but you.
very true. It's very true. All right, Cheever. So what do you think then, bringing up what Curtis says, is most likely Tesla is probably not going to take responsibility for this. So let's think here. Is it maybe the seller of the unit that's at fault here, or maybe it's the person who owned the car that shouldn't store their data? What do you think? What do you think is going to happen here? Are people going to be more careful?
I think it's the service center's issue, because realistically, if my infotainment system is no longer responding to user inputs and I take it in for repair, the service center should reset it, because the user of the vehicle can't. You know, I've seen this time and time and time again. This actually kind of reminds me of a problem that came up with Enterprise Rent-A-Car, where a Ford vehicle with the new sync was not reset. And the person that had rented that car previously and installed the sync app on his phone was able to start, stop, unlock, lock, and get real-time information on the location of that vehicle long after he'd turned that vehicle in. So I think this is going to be a new world. We're going to have to start thinking, you know, how are we going to get rid of things? My personal opinion is, gee, we have those key fobs and it's really convenient that we can keep it in our pocket, but maybe we should be plugging it in to our infotainment system as like a USB drive or something like that, so that all my PII sits on the key fob, not in the infotainment system. So I think I'm going to predict a landmark class action suit. And I think it's going to be really entertaining to see what happens.
I think so too. I think the interesting thing here is Tesla gloats the amount of security they work through, especially since they consider themselves a software company more than a automobile company. So I think this is the interesting thing, is they're storing things on this unit. I mean, anybody who has can go and break a window and steal a unit could basically steal somebody's entire life of information when they get their passwords and data. So I think this is a very odd thing that was brought out. So I'm guessing that Tesla will, under the covers, probably start taking action to go fix these problems. But in the same issue, it's kind of surprising. Okay, well, we'll close up on that bite, because I think we have another really interesting one from Curtis. Curtis, threat modeling, it's not an easy thing. What is this MITRE attack?
Okay, so back in 2015, MITRE, which is a think tank and research company that basically figures out things for the government that the government doesn't really want to figure out for itself, came up with a model called the ATTACK framework. That's spelled ATTACK. And this is a way that has become the industry de facto method for cataloging attacks and understanding how an organization can respond to those attacks. Now, it can be really useful for risk professionals or anyone who's charged with figuring out risk to help you understand which attacks can be the most damaging and how often those risks could occur. Now, we don't have time here to go through the entire attack model. I will suggest that people go through and do that for themselves. But basically, I'll say this. If you have ever heard someone in security talk about shifting response or shifting security left, then they're taking that language from the attack model. Now, the great place that this is used is walking someone through the different steps of a particular risk, all the way from reconnaissance, where the criminal tries to figure out where your weak spots are, to gaining persistence and exfiltrating data. And there are a number of steps between those, and there are different steps depending upon exactly what kind of risk is being faced. Now, just to give you an example, non-IT internal employees, someone, say, in accounting or in marketing, could try to brute force their way to credential access or find credentials that are written down somewhere. That's a spot in the framework. Cyber criminals attempting account takeovers tend to use man-in-the-middle website proxies and do two-factor authentication interception. And there's some overlap, but that's shown on the framework at a slightly different point. What you have to do is map from the framework to your organization to determine how likely it is that a particular risk would occur. The next thing that you can do using the attack model is figuring out how often that could occur. And anyone who's done risk analysis knows that you have very high impact events that occur once every 100 years and high impact events that occur on average once every month. There are low impact events at different frequencies. And what you have to do when you're figuring out how you're going to defend against them or how you're going to respond to these risks is figure out which have the greatest impact and the greatest frequency and defend against those first. Now, this helps people who are managing go through and figure out where they're going to deploy their resources. Now, like I said, I'm going to encourage everyone to go out to the website attck.mitre.org and take a look. You'll find this very interesting, very useful, and really, once you look at it, very, very simple to understand. Now, Lou, I'm going to come to you with a question. You and I were talking before the show about frameworks and doing risk analysis, and you said that the attack model is not one that you've used. When you've had to do this, were you using a formal framework?
I was not, but I know that the other security teams that I've worked with and they provide our guidance do. In fact, you know, we at Microsoft have obviously dedicated red and blue teams that go and, you know, exploit various techniques. They use exploit, you know, various techniques to exploit things. But most companies don't have that. So a framework like MITRE could really help emulate what you need to do. And I think that's really a necessity when it comes to an organization who don't have those types of professionals to assist. For somebody like me, who's not a security professional, that needs to understand what the risks are and, again, how to go mitigate them. So I definitely think this is a great framework to have, especially for organizations who don't have those kind of special red and blue teams.
I think it's fascinating to see. Obviously, this is something that risk professionals use all the time, and you really can't have a conversation with one of them without knowing the terminology within the attack framework. Brian, I know that you have been involved in various ways looking at security and response. Is the MITRE attack framework something that you've had cause to use?
Actually, a lot of my experience predates the MITRE model. And interesting enough, a lot of the work I did, because it was compartmentalized, was air gap from the rest of the world. So the risk analysis was actually a lot different. Now, what we did use some framework, more checklists from MITRE, was for physical security. Especially when we're designing things. So frameworks like this are not new. They've been around for a very, very long time. I actually saw a classified document from World War II that was still pertinent, which is kind of interesting. So things like this exist. Their biggest function is to create consistency in how you set up audits, creates consistency in how you set up new infrastructure. And it makes it a lot easier because it has a direct impact on training. Because especially in the military, where people get moved around so much. If the systems are radically different at each location, that means you spend a good amount of time in your rotation schedule just in learning the new systems. So when you have frameworks, it means what was familiar at Fort Hood is now familiar at Pearl Harbor. So life ought to be interesting. And yeah, I think this is a great thing. And I think we're going to see a lot more frameworks coming up as time goes on.
You know, one of the things that Brian just mentioned was this commonality of language. And that's why botanists use scientific names, why biologists use scientific names rather than common names, because common names can change from place to place, but it's the scientific name that is consistent throughout the world. Having consistent naming conventions is something that, well, frankly, the cybersecurity industry has struggled over, because each research team tends to have its own naming conventions for things that it finds. Something like the MITRE ATT&CK framework gives us that common language, a common point of understanding where we can have meaningful conversations between teams to figure out what the dangers are and how we're all going to respond to them. Well, that's it for my bite. I have a strong suspicion that Lou is standing ready with another ad and the entry point to our guest for this week.
Indeed. Thank you, Curtis. Well, before we get to my favorite part of the show, where we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on our Twilight Riot here, we have to thank another great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Thinks Canary. Now, with everything that's going on in the world, Thinks Canary wants you to know they're here for you. Now, data breaches are on the rise, and companies usually find out too late they have been compromised, even after spending millions on IT security. Now, Canary is designed to be installed and configured and most likely forgotten in minutes. Well, get ready, because Thinks Canary has a great solution that will make it easy for you to catch breachers in the act. Now, if you do need to be alerted, Canary gives you the option of deciding how you'd like to be told, email or text message, in fact, on your console directly, or Slack, webhooks, syslog, or even just their API if you want to integrate it somewhere else. Now, alerts should be dead simple and easy to work with, conforming to your needs, not the other way around. And Thinks Canary has made that possible. Now, you won't be inundated with alerts either. You'll get the only one that matters when you actually needed it. Though, two things all companies should know when it comes to data breaches: hackers take the path of least resistance. Guess what? Sometimes that's your staff. And it takes an average of 191 days for a company to realize that their data has been breached. Now, here's how the Canary works. It looks identical to a router, a switch, or an NAS server, a Linux box, or even a Windows server, so attackers can't tell the difference. Now, Thinks Canary doesn't look vulnerable on your network. It looks valuable and appealing. Now, you can put fake files on them or enroll them in Active Directory. Now, when attackers investigate further, they give themselves away and you're instantly notified. Now, the company behind Canary has been in the security game for almost 2 decades. They've trained companies, militaries, and governments on how to break into networks and have used that knowledge to build Canary. Now, Thinks Canary are deployed all over the world on all 7 continents and are one of the best tools against data breaches. Now, visit canary.tools/twit, and for just $7,500 per year, you'll get 5 canaries, your own hosted console, upgrade support, and maintenance. And if you use code TWIT on the How Do You Hear About Us box, you'll get 10% off the price for life. Well, we know you'll love Thinks Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return your canaries with their 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/twit, and enter the code TWIT on the How Do You Hear About Us box. And we thank Thinks Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, it's now my favorite part of the show. We get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on our Twilight Riot here. And today we have Mike Cotton, SVP of Engineering at Digital Defense. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Now, our audience loves to hear people's journey through tech. Can you maybe take us through a short journey through tech and how you ended up at Digital Defense?
Yeah. I was working in the data networking space, you know, and I liked it. I mean, I loved, you know, the ways, you know, analyzing how computers talk to each other. And I was part of the team that was focused on locking down our systems against attack. And you know, like a lot of other people, I thought, you know, what would be even cooler than locking down our systems against attack is looking at a lot more networks, a lot more data, and just seeing, you know, how do these attacks occur, and, you know, how do these attacker tactics allow people to take over all systems, not just one system? And so that's what I get to do at Digital Defense. I get to go ahead and look at a lot of networks, and then we have automated systems that go out and highlight potential flaws that attackers can take advantage of. So,
yeah, especially in this climate, this is, I think, it's a very important topic. Now, I know that from a fact that lots of organizations are struggling because they kind of lack the security professionals. They might have great IT and network engineering people, but security is a whole kind of other ball of wax. Can you maybe take us through what you're seeing organizations are doing to correct that gap?
Yeah. So right now, I mean, we're in sort of a crisis, obviously. There's been a huge shift where all these IT teams have gotten a mandate to go ahead and open up remote work, you know, make things accessible, get stuff online, really so the businesses could survive. But that was a very rapid shift. And so now they're turning around and trying to go through and lock down all these new access points and services that they brought online. It typically is a combination of analyzing what they've already put up. You'd like them to do it beforehand, but, you know, a lot of times it's after the fact due to business need, and also pushing security training at their users. You know, unfortunately, right now, a lot of it's just headline driven. They're scrambling to keep up with the latest headlines that are hitting, you know, things like Zoom bombing. But it's really a combination of addressing device flaws and sort of the human flaws.
Yeah, you brought up a good point. I mean, I think that with the remote workforce, things are changing even more rapidly. So sometimes even user or, you know, individual education is even tougher. You know, what kinds of things are you seeing there? What has changed even with the remote workforce side of things?
You know, it's something where, you know, the remote workforce is, you have some people are very sophisticated at it and have been doing it for a long time. Right. A lot of companies that are good at it, but now everyone has to do it all at once. And we're seeing a lot of times where people just sort of basic things like how do I video conference without giving away security? Am I allowed to send files through, you know, maybe my personal email system because I need to get it from point A to point B and I can't figure out how to do it through the file sharing system? So a lot of times lots and lots of quick change is bad for security. And unfortunately, now we're going through quick change very, very rapidly. So,
right. Now, I'm sure that you're probably finding kind of an abundance of unprotected endpoints. Are you guys seeing a lot of this in different organizations?
Yeah, we are. So the two big shifts that we've seen is there's been a huge shift to bring online devices that support remote access and remote work. And so we're seeing a lot more of those and invulnerable configurations. And then we are also seeing a lot more endpoint software, you know, things like WebEx or, you know, video conferencing software, where, you know, the corporate systems haven't necessarily caught up to being able to push patches down to those. So you're seeing both server-side vulnerabilities and client-side vulnerabilities explode as companies are going through this rapid shift.
Right. Now, does a good maybe VM program help here?
Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the things where you know, VM really helps you out a lot in the sense that a lot of times companies are maybe a little less sophisticated about security. They focus on patching, and patching is good and it's important. But what VM helps you do is it helps you understand, you know, did the patching get applied everywhere? And then there's also a certain class of configuration flaws. Some of these are the most dangerous flaws, in my opinion. Where, you know, regardless of a system is patched, you know, if it's an insecure configuration, the patching won't address that. And so it allows you to get out those flaws where, you know, if an attacker looks and recons your network in a particular fashion, there are certain things he's going to be looking for in order to go ahead and break in. And what VM attempts to do is take those things and move them to the top of your priority list so you can go ahead and kind of work to close them out before an attacker comes through and takes advantage of them. So
I do want to bring my co-host back in because they're chomping at the bit here. So I want to start with Curtis. Curtis, you wanted to talk a little about security effectiveness.
Well, one of the things I'm curious about, I was looking over at the website, and you talk about the option for active scanning versus passive. Can you talk a little bit about just how active you get in scanning to find out where some of these vulnerabilities exist are, and how actively you scan to find out what sort of configuration errors might be in place?
Yeah, no, we really try. So our background as a company, actually, we started out in penetration tests, you know, which is a great place to start out because you have a very real world, you know, viewpoint of the sorts of things that attackers take advantage of. And so our scanning technology actually mimics in a lot of ways the same sorts of host discovery sweeps and port scanning techniques. It's all proprietary. You know, we don't use open source tools. We built our own systems for that. So we actually do send a lot of packets and probes, and, you know, we have the ability to trigger flaws based on version numbers, but wherever possible, we'd like to hit the attack vector itself. You know, we'd like to see if we can trigger a condition that really indicates a different branch in the code, you know, whether it actually executes a small piece of code or does some sort of a ping back from a device if, you know, the payload can be executed in a safe fashion, to indicate true vulnerability. Because a lot of times, you know, the challenge and sort of the knock on vulnerability management programs in the past has been, you know, they dump a mountain of data on you, and then, you know, it's not clear what should be prioritized, what is truly critical, you know, and that may be a way that, you know, things like, you know, the attack framework can help out, because that's been a struggle with the industry. Like, what truly matters? You know, where do I need to focus my efforts?
Well, speaking of where to focus efforts, I know that one of the things that we've been writing about fairly often is the grief that can be introduced through misconfigured S3 buckets. You can have all kinds of misconfigurations out in the cloud. How do you deal with these hybrid infrastructures? Are you capable of going out and looking at both the cloud and the on-prem parts of an infrastructure?
Yeah, we do. We have we actually have a AWS marketplace appliance. We have an Azure marketplace appliance. And that was something that it was a trend we saw, and it was also a trend our customers were pushing us for, because we saw them start to stand up at first sort of outposts in these virtual cloud networks, you know, virtual private clouds, as AWS calls them. And more of that shift has been going online or up to the cloud. And so their networks are becoming more complex. And with this crisis, that is, you know, just exploding. You know, people are saying, oh, great, we've got all this cloud infrastructure. Let's use it more, which is great. It's good they're doing that. But, you know, with the S3 buckets in particular, you know, I think AWS had a good term saying we need to phrase, and we really need to help our customers, you know, audit and improve their security more with these S3 buckets. It's not something where we're, you know, they have this idea of the shared responsibility model, things we're responsible for, things you're responsible for. It was apparent that people were struggling too much with their side of the shared responsibility model. And so now the cloud vendors are coming over and trying to help more. And I think that's a good trend.
Yeah, I think Amazon was struggling to find a way to say we want to help our customers be about 24% less stupid. and they may or may not have succeeded at that. Well, you know, you were talking about the complexity of the infrastructure, and in a lot of cases, we look at that just back on the application delivery side of things. But I think that the current work from home environment especially has shown that in many cases, we've got what amount to uncontrolled endpoints out there. Laptops, desktops, even tablets that are sitting in customer and employee homes that are now being, you know, de facto parts of our enterprise network. Now, when you're looking at configurations, do you extend all the way out to those endpoints, or do you stay on the application delivery side of things?
We typically stay on the application delivery side of things, though we are rolling out a new cloud agent, you know, this quarter, which should be able to allow people to even audit the endpoints themselves. You know, we typically work with their upstream information and work with that, but we have had enough requests now that we're opening up even agent-based auditing on the endpoint in addition to all the other sorts of information we collect.
Very good. Well, you know, it sounds like you have a very comprehensive sort of program here. So, you know, I do have to ask, you mentioned that you come from a background of red teaming, of pen testing. In a typical engagement, are you setting up a service that you now leave in place with your customers? Are you doing it on an engagement basis? And, you know, is this the sort of thing where, you know, a customer throws you, you know, a credit card for a subscription, you give them some keys and they're off to the races? Or does it typically involve a lot of professional services as well?
It really depends. I mean, we have customers that are very sophisticated and they, you know, have their own penetration testing teams and they just want to have an automated tool that sweeps and lets them know what the vulnerabilities are and what can be exploited. We have other customers who they're really just looking for a penetration test. The ones that we see most often are people who want both. They both want, you know, a mechanism to keep track of the flaws and stay on top of them and shut them down. And then they want, sometimes for compliance purposes, sometimes for security purposes, to have a, you know, quarterly or biannual penetration test to verify, yes, we are staying on top of these things. We are closing down these attack vectors before people can take advantage of it. You know, one thing that's good about working on both sides of the fence there is, you know, it keeps us honest. It's hard for us to give someone a clean bill of health and then turn around and just light up their network in a penetration test. And it's also hard, you know, the reverse is also true. It's hard for us to tell people, oh, you have critical vulnerabilities all over the place and you're going to get owned any minute. And then, you know, we strike out on a penetration test. So those are the primary business drivers for us.
Hey, Jeff, I'm a big soapbox person. And one of the keynotes that I saw at not too long ago, Black Hat by Dan Gere, was about the real politic of cybersecurity. And one of the key points was how the true edge of the corporate internet isn't the traditional perimeter. It's actually the home, because more and more people are working from home. Mm-hmm. So my question for you is, I'd like you to soapbox just a little bit. Do you think we're ignoring the true edge? Do we need to start thinking about trying to set policies to get people off those really cheap, super vulnerable El Cheapo firewalls and put something more reasonable in? Or should we extend it all the way to the corporate laptop or tablet and secure the actual endpoint? Soapbox for me, please.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the, you know, if I could see, point to a trend that kind of extends to the home and or to personal and is starting to infiltrate corporate and affect corporate in a big way, you know, I think it's the way that people are using these online services and really leaking credentials all over the place through these data breaches, which then attackers turn around and will often leverage these sorts of credential stuffing attacks against corporate systems, or maybe they have tied, you know, personal email to some account that also is impacting corporate data. Things like a Dropbox account, you know, something where it's like, it's my Dropbox account. It's like, well, you know, I use it at home and work and kind of for both. You know, I've had it for a while. So those sorts of, you know, I remember talking to some Cisco network engineers when Dropbox was first getting big, and they told me sort of an interesting factoid that that was the first time they'd ever just banned a service at Cisco, because they had seen how many terabytes of data was flowing out of the company and they didn't really have control over it. And because they service everyone as sort of that old school networking company, that was not something they'd done before. Like they typically wouldn't even ban something most companies would, like, you know, adult or risque sites, because those might be their customers. And so what we're seeing, I think, you know, and we do some security education training, and one of the things that we push and we wish companies would push more is you've got to educate your users about personal, you know, cloud service use and how to keep those barriers up. That is the thing that is tending. We see a big wave coming with credential stuffing attacks and how open those services are. So,
you know, my last soapbox. One of the things I'm actually starting to see personally is the pandemic has changed the world. You know, I think we're all in agreement on that. But I think one of the things that it's having a really big impact on actually is cybersecurity. People are becoming more aware. People are becoming more afraid. Do you think we ought to fan the flames, so to speak? You know, is it working in our – have you seen the pandemic working in your favor or against you, I guess, is the big question.
Like from the perspective of a person trying to secure networks or a person who, you know, sometimes is involved in penetration tests, you know, like what – when you say working for me, are you saying do you think the pandemic is helping people – you know, kind of advance up the IT ladder and security ladder and lock things down? Is that the question?
Kinds of my biggest challenge is user education. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually starting to hear more conversations from end users about cybersecurity, whereas they've not done anything. Are you starting to see that too?
Yeah, I do think the pandemic has started to, you know, it started a lot of useful conversations. You know, you've seen how Zoom is obviously sort of rocketing up the stock market, you know, but then all of a sudden rampant security issues hit them, you know, and it's starting to say, hey, is this going to become a viability issue for the business? And then Google comes out and they ban Zoom across their entire enterprise, and so does Tesla. And a number of high profile incidents. And so, you know, I think there are a lot of useful conversations where people can no longer just sit in the mindset, sort of that old traditional mindset of, you know, we keep everything inside the perimeter, we protect the perimeter, and then, you know, it's like a castle. We've got these walls around us, and the people inside don't need to necessarily be all that sophisticated because we've got guards up all around them. Well, now that people can't, you know, live in that world anymore. You know, they know their employees have got to get stuff done, and they're out there. You know, they're on unprotected home networks, potentially misconfigured. They're using their laptop often in a way where, you know, they may be accessing, you know, content, which is, you know, really high risk. You know, maybe they're, you know, using it for personal, you know, but also using it for office use. Well, if you're at the office, you can catch that easily. Once they turn off the VPN, I don't know, you know, infected system, you know, a lot of times, you know, the infected system that is trusted through straight into the corporate network. So, it definitely presents a huge risk, but fortunately I'm seeing enough buzz now that I think, you know, even teams that were living in sort of an alternate universe or maybe had a more traditional security mindset, they're waking up to the fact they need to do more to protect their users.
Thank you, Mike. So I think I did want to go in a little bit about some of the tools that Digital Defense has, because there's some pretty fantastic tools. I was learning about Frontline, and, you know, its defense mechanisms and its capabilities around threat management, vulnerability management. Can you maybe take mm-hmm. us through some of its what organizations can do when they're using Frontline?
Yeah. So it's a cloud-based vulnerability management system. You know, that's a cloud-based portal, and then you can download scanning appliances. You know, or virtual scanning appliances that sit at various points in your network and can sort of sweep through your network, you know, like an attacker would, and they can audit web applications. We have special, you know, tools for that. And then we also have tools that focus on sort of classic exploitable vulnerabilities. And so, you know, the point of Frontline is to really recon the entire network. So many people don't know what they have. And you don't just hear this from people who work in vuln management. You know, even people who work in antivirus will say, you know, we ask people how many systems they have, and we always, you know, tell our people, assume it's 25% or 30% more than they tell you, because people don't even know what's on their network typically. And so it sort of helps you map out your network. You know, we have a mapping capability, and we can sort of show you the hot spots, which areas are most open to attack, and give you a prioritized list of, you know, what we, you know, as people who work on, you know, have sort of an attacker mindset, what we would suggest you close down first in order to go ahead and secure your network. So
now there's also some threat intelligence capabilities in it as well, right?
Yeah. We consume, I think, about 20 threat feeds right now. And so what the threat feeds help you do is they help you kind of sit on top of more traditional scoring mechanisms like CVSS, which, you know, attempt to rate, you know, the vulnerability on a scale of 1 to 10. But the threat feeds actually tell you, okay, not just what the vendor says, but what is actually going out there in the real world. Because, you know, a lot of times vendors, and this was sort of a CYA, you know, they'd say, oh, yeah, it's critical. Everything's, you know, critical patch. Go ahead and apply it. Because they didn't want to end up in a situation where they marked something as like a low or a medium, and then it turned out it really was more severe than they realized. And so so by bringing in the threat intelligence, you can actually see, okay, you know, for my vertical, maybe it's healthcare, you know, is this something, a vulnerability that people are targeting against hospitals, you know, or against financial institutions? Because if I am in that vertical and it's in the wild, boy, I really need to get on this above everything else. So it just gives more context and better ranking and prioritization to the vulnerabilities.
Mike, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time. I did want to give you a chance to maybe tell the folks at home where they can go and find out more about Digital Defense and how can they see some of your new offerings.
Yeah. You can go to digitaldefense.com, and we have a free trial available too. You can click through, sign up for service, and you know, just run a quick sweep on some systems. I think we allow, I think, up to 255 IPs, I think, on a default trial, you know. And so, you know, maybe sweep your external perimeter systems or sort of critical servers you have, and just, you know, get a quick view of your security risk posture, you know, and maybe everything's locked down. Maybe you're good to go, but, you know, if you're not, it's a lot better to know that before the attackers find out.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. And you should stop resisting the urge to play us during your virtual social hour. But I want to make sure I thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with Mr. Brian Cheeber. What's going on for you this coming week, and where can people find you?
This week is house repairs, and then once a week I'm going in and helping to deploy a new underwater observatory. In fact, one of these fine days, I'm hoping to be able to share a URL with the Twilight Riot so you can watch the fishies in the reef off Waikiki Beach. Well, I am on Twitter, ADVNETLAB, or Cheebert, spelled CHEEBERT, at twit.tv. But better yet, why don't you use Twilight at twit.tv and hit all the hosts. Love to hear you. Love to hear your show ideas.
Fantastic. Thanks, Cheebert. Well, we also thank Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on with you for the coming week, and where can people find you and all of your work?
Well, as always, people can find what I write at Dark Reading and the Edge of Dark Reading. Got some pieces coming up on things like different tips for securing a supply chain. That will be up soon. Did a piece today on the matter of security effectiveness and how good or not so good we're doing at that as an industry. I'll be pointing to all of my pieces on Twitter at KG4GWA. look forward to seeing people from the Twiat Riot there to let me know how I'm doing.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You are the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to catch on your enterprise news. So go out now, right now, to our show page, twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, show notes, information about the co-hosts and the guests, as well as links that we do about the stories that we do during the show. Of course, more importantly, next to those videos there, you get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting those audio versions, your video versions, and your HD video versions of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices and on any one of your podcast applications as well. It's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. So definitely go ahead and subscribe. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, and your coworkers by sharing the gift of Twiat with them as well. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available during the day on Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do the show live, live.twit.tv. Come and see how the show is run, all the behind the scenes, the banter and the fun that we have here at Twit. Plus, if you are going to watch the show live, might as well jump into the chat room live as well at irc.twit.tv. There we have some really great characters. We love the chat room. We have some great discussions before and during and after the show. So go ahead and jump in there and be part of the discussion. But if you can't watch the show live and you can't be part of the live discussion, there's also another discussion going on 24/7 over at twit.community. That's our great website to bring the Twit community together off peak times. So if you want to check that out, go to twit.community and be part of the discussion 24/7. Remember, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits and, of course, conversations with great people like you. Plus, you can see what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft. And if you want to check out what's going on there, go to dev.office.com. There we see the latest and greatest ways to customize Office and make it more productive for you. And also remember, don't forget Microsoft Build May 19th through the 21st. Don't forget that. It's live and it's free online. So check that out. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week, and we really couldn't do this show without them. So thank you for your support, Leo and Lisa. Also, thank you all the engineers at Twit. Thank you for all the support. We couldn't do this show without you as well. Also, we have to thank Mr. Brian Chee one more time. Chee is not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. And we couldn't do the show because otherwise we wouldn't have any bookings or plannings for the show. So thank you, Chee, for all your support, sir. And, of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Jeff. Jeff, thank you so much for your support, man. Are you still the lone man in the studio there?
I am. The only one here. The lights went off in the hallway, so it's all dark out there. But I do have to say this.
You didn't move enough. You got to move a little bit more so the lights stay on.
This was a really great show. It's a really hard question to ask what positive came out of this virus. You know, I know that was a hard question to ask. But, you know, when it comes to the streaming technology that's going on there, it's pretty amazing. And the companies really are ramping up to meet the challenge, as well as the security companies like you guys talked about. So I thought that was a really interesting show, and it's going to be interesting to find out where it goes from here. Great guest and great host, you guys. Good job.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.